So welcome all to the first Q&A in June. Just a reminder that we are doing the audio recording. The recording, the deck, and the contents of the chat window will go up on the website later on this evening. We have a fair amount of stuff on the agenda, but hopefully we'll have some time for additional questions and comments. If you have any questions and comments, let me actually mute all right now. So you do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please do so if you have any questions or comments, or enter it into the chat. If you do unmute yourself, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and good evening, everyone. Chris said we have a fair amount of material, so we'll get right to it. And first question is, what is this thing? And a neighbor, during the power outage, a neighbor told me about this thing in a local park, and clearly it's got an array of solar cells on top of it, and it turns out it's actually a solar-powered charging station for USB devices. So down the bottom there, in the middle of the stem, there's a whole raft of USB ports with a waterproof cover on it. And these are City of Ottawa devices, but they're terribly secret, because if you go on the website, you won't find anything about them anywhere, as far as I can tell. So I don't know if anybody else knows about these things, and you have one in your neighborhood. I believe there's one at City Hall. But maybe you'll find one in your local park or community center.
I bet there's a call for even more of them after the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Okay, moving along to smartphones. And a question was, one of the simple question was, how do you connect Wi-Fi? And the easy answer is you go to settings and connections, and there you should find a Wi-Fi option. If it's turned off, then you basically just slide this toggle over to turn the thing on. And once you do that, then the phone will scan and see what's around. And in the real world, it'll find whatever is in your locale. And here I did it close to one of the branches of the public library. So all it found was the library connection. And typically to click on this link here, will allow me to access the library Wi-Fi. Well, at least it more or less will. it basically says, click here to sign into the network. Well, this is a library, so more than one click is always a good idea. So you click on this one, then you can click on this one, and eventually you will get to somewhere where it needs to you to enter your library card number and your password, the PIN. And then that will actually get you onto the library's website. And that's fairly typical if you go to Timmy Hortons or McDonald's or somebody, they typically want you to join their network before they'll give you access to the local Wi-Fi there. Basically, the same kind of thing will happen at home. At home, it'll look around, and again, here it's only found one Wi-Fi network. But of course, if you live in an apartment, you may find that there's Bell 3496 and Bell 6298 and Bell 1364. There'll be a whole bunch of routers with Bell type number names. And so a good idea would be to change the SSID to something that you recognize as being your Bell router or your Rogers router, whoever's router it is, something that you recognize and you know it's you that you want to connect to. And then typically when you connect to this network, it will want a password. But when you enter the password, if you toggle on this button, auto reconnect, then it will remember that password and it won't ask you again. So that's a quick and easy way to get onto your home Wi-Fi network with your smartphone or your tablet. Okay, moving along, we have another thing about phones, and Chris is going to tell us about how to bank.
Yeah, how to bank. You had a question come into the suggestion box at opcug.ca. Liette was wondering that about using her phone to do bank transactions. And so she had thought that it might not be as secure as using her laptop, and so therefore had been using her laptop and wondered if that was, you know, a valid concern or not. Next. So as most things security related and computer related, that depends. You know, almost always when you're looking at security risks and so forth, you almost never can completely eliminate risks. So you can hopefully mitigate some, you can hopefully evaluate some and decide whether the benefit outweighs whatever residual risk there is. So let's take a look at some of the risks that I sort of looked at. By the way, as we're going through this, if anybody argues with me on this, on any of the points, by all means, chime in, because I don't think there are absolutes with this, and I may be totally off the mark on some things. I may be missing some nuances. So please feel free to jump in. So next. So one of the first ones I thought about was if you have a keystroke logger on your device, whatever your device is. And so if you have a keystroke logger that has been maliciously installed on your computer, the attacker, whoever it was who installed it, can see all your keystrokes, which would include your login credentials as you get to your banking site, if you're logging in through a website or whatever that is, you know, asking you for a password or an account number, the attacker would be able to see that. The thing about this is that the risk is actually there regardless of what you're using, whether it's a desktop PC, a laptop that's on a wired connection, or a laptop on a Wi-Fi connection, your phone on a Wi-Fi, or your phone on the mobile network. So the risk is the same, because it's really the fact that if you have something installed on your computing device that is capturing keystrokes and sending it off to an attacker, it'll happen whatever the platform is. Now, if you are worried about that particular risk, then I think you have something more fundamental to worry about, because you really have more than just your banking at risk. And so you really have to get rid of that keystroke logger. Antivirus software is the most common means of dealing with keystroke loggers. And so you can, I hope everybody has got active antivirus on most of their computing devices, if not all. And you can always go and do free on-demand scans from a number of vendors that are out there if you think that your chosen antivirus program may be missing something. Next. So the next one I identified was the idea that your network traffic might get intercepted. And so, again, the attacker is going to be able to see everything that you type, including your login details and so forth. But there is effective mitigation for this, and that's encryption. So for banking, you are going to end up with end-to-end encryption. And so network traffic getting intercepted, the attacker is only going to get gobbledygook, and there's no practical means for them to decode that and get back your plain text login credentials and so forth. So it's not something that really concerns me except for one instance. And that's a man-in-the-middle attack. So if we look in here, what we've got is the top left computer is your computing device, whether it's your laptop, desktop, or phone. And then let's say you are at a Tim Hortons Wi-Fi, and they have a Wi-Fi. The top right-hand corner is Tim Hortons Wi-Fi, which is called Tim Hortons. Now, that's its SSID. Now, the attacker comes in the bottom left-hand corner. They bring up an access point, and they call it Tim Hortons as well. Well, the trouble with Wi-Fi is that it goes by the SSID name. And so there's no real authentication to say that this Tim Hortons is any different than the Tim Hortons Wi-Fi that is brought up by the company itself. Because in this case, it's got a stronger signal, you're more likely to connect to it rather than connecting to the real Tim Hortons. And then we see our bank site off in the bottom right-hand corner. So next. So what you do is you connect to Tim Hortons. And because the attacker's Tim Hortons access point has a stronger signal, you end up connecting to that. And it just happily makes the connection, as it would connecting to the legitimate Tim Hortons. And you make a request to a connection to the bank. Now, all automatic, of course, is not manual, but the attacker's computer will then connect to the real Tim Hortons Wi-Fi, and then it will actually connect to the bank. And it'll pass the information back and forth between the bank and their device to your device. And from your perspective, you can't really tell that this information is just being passed back and forth. Next. Now, there is encryption on here, but note that it's not end-to-end encryption. It is end-to-end, but it's just not the ends that you expect. So you have an encrypted session between your computing device and the attacker's computer that is hosting that access point. So you have end-to-end encryption on there, and then the attacker makes an end-to-end encryption encrypted session between their computer through the Tim Hortons Wi-Fi to the bank computer, and everything seems hunky-dory to everybody. You just don't realize that the information is being encoded and decoded, or encrypted and decrypted, at the attacker's computer as it's passed back and forth. So you have encrypted data going to the attacker's computer. They decrypt it. They then re-encrypt it using the other session that they have live to the bank. Next. So mitigations for man-in-the-middle attack. First is, I think, multi-factor authentication. It's not perfect in all instances. Certainly if you're just getting an SMS code to your phone or something like that, it's not necessarily going to stop an attacker, but it does make it harder for an attacker. And some forms of multi-factor authentication may indeed stop the attacker in their tracks. I'm just not absolutely sure how much harder it's going to be, but for sure it's going to add another layer to the attacker's stance, and it may make it impossible for them to do it. It just may make it a little bit more difficult. Another thing you can do is check the security certificate when logging on. If you're logging on through a web, you'll get an option to be able to check the certificate on that, and I'll show you that in just a little bit on how you can actually do that. The reason why that is effective is that it's really hard for the attacker to pretend to have your bank's security certificate. Another option would be to use your bank's mobile app. Mobile apps can actually be encoded or coded so that they prevent man-in-the-middle attacks. There's means of doing that. It's just not really practical in a browser sense. But when you're actually dealing with at an application level, then it is actually quite easy for the bank to code it so that man-in-the-middle attacks just cannot happen. And because it's possible to do so, I'm certainly hopeful that all banks would actually incorporate anti-man-in-the-middle attack coding into their apps. If you're using web access to the bank, you could avoid Wi-Fi. So if you're on either a mobile network, or if you're plugged into RJ45 Ethernet jack, it's much harder for somebody to sniff the traffic and set up the man-in-the-middle attack. Again, not 100% perfect, but certainly is a strong mitigation. So I sat back, though, and I thought about a reality check. Is a man-in-the-middle attack really a significant risk? I don't think it really is. I mean, it's possible, certainly. It has been done, yes. Is it likely? I don't think so. On your average place that you go to, your Tim Hortons or your McDonald's or whatever public Wi-Fi spot, the chances that you're going to be subjected to a man-in-the-middle attack is probably really, really low. However, keep those mitigations on the top part of that slide in mind, because if you are concerned about it, they can certainly help. Next. So the bottom line, I think, keep all your devices free of any sort of malware, including keystroke loggers, which I just count as being one other piece of malware on there. If you are on the phone, which this came about as an original question about doing it on a phone, if you only install apps from the Google Play Store, you're probably more secure. It's not that malware has never appeared in the Google Play Store, but it's more likely to be dealt with rapidly if it shows up in the Google Play Store than if you get an app from somewhere else. Fortunately, on Android and on iOS, they make it that the default is that you can only get it from the official Play Store. And with Apple, you have to jailbreak your device. On Android, you can actually change a setting to allow for installation of apps from other sources. If you're paranoid about these things, don't enable that option. Just get your stuff from the Google Play Store. If you are on a smartphone, you're probably most secure if you're on the mobile network or a personal Wi-Fi rather than a public Wi-Fi. It's probably safest if you use the bank's mobile app, and it seems like all of the banks have a mobile app available. So if your bank has one, if you want to do banking from your phone, it's probably more secure to do that. And it's probably fine to use web access from your phone. You could have slightly higher risks, but quite frankly, for most cases, I don't think the risk is very high at all. If you're on a laptop on someone else's network, so a public network or just an untrusted network that you don't control, it's always good practice to check the security certificate. I do this every now and then, just as a random thing. So next, the way you do that is in your browser, you just click the lock that is next to the URL, and it'll bring up a dropdown, and you'll see connection is secure. So you click on that, and then you'll get another one here, and there will be details that'll show there. Now, the level of details you get at this level may be variable from this. I believe that this was done using Edge. I'm not 100% sure. And you can see here it says certificate is valid, issued to Alterna Savings and Credit Union Limited CA. So that alone is pretty good for me to see that, yes, I have connected to my bank's website as opposed to some attacker who's doing a man-in-the-middle attack. However, I could click on that, and I could actually get further details. And if you do go down to this level, what you want to do, you're going to get to the certificate itself, the properties of the certificate. You go to the details tab and then go down to subject property. And then in the subject property, there will be an O for organizational unit. And it will actually say who the certificate was issued to. And in this case, I can see Alternative Savings Credit Union Limited. And so I know the certificate was issued to my actual bank. So you can do that if you're in a browser. You can check the certificate if you really want to be sure of who it is that you're connecting to. I do have an article that I put out on in the newsletter. I should have the URL to it. I don't. About what HTTPS really means. And it talks a little bit about that. If you're on a secure connection where you have HTTPS and the lock, all you're sure of is that you have an encrypted session to somebody. It's only by checking that in the certificate that you can validate who it is you're connected. You could have a secure connection to an attacker. So last slide I have here for securing computers, this is some generic information with some highlights to phones. So antivirus, anti-spyware, I think all laptops, desktops should have that installed on it. A lot of people forego it on the smartphones. And I think that is, it's not terrible as long as you get your apps from the Google Play Store. Again, there is a vetting process on there. If you're getting apps from elsewhere, who knows what they are. So there are free options on Android, such as Sophos Intercept X that is available. I have that installed on my phone. It's never given me any alerts that there are problems on my phone, but it can check a number of settings on your phone and give you recommendations that will increase the security. Firewalls on a PC, on a desktop, a laptop, firewalls are pretty important because you're actually running services, whether you like it or not, on Windows. There are a number of what's known as ports that are open listening for incoming connections. You want those blocked. Smartphones generally don't run services, and so they are not presenting anything that an attacker can attach to. So there's limited benefit to maybe no benefit to really having a firewall on a phone. As long as, again, you only install apps from the Google Play Store. If you install from somewhere else, who knows what that app may be coded to actually do. Patch management is important, and we've talked about that a number of times on the PC side in Windows. On smartphones, they make it really, really easy to stay up to date on the patches, as long as, again, you only install apps from the Google Play Store. If you get an app from somewhere else, you have to be responsible to check to see whether there are updates to that particular app. Google Play Store does a very, very good job of making sure that all your apps are kept up to date, as long as you pay attention to it and you tell it to go ahead and install the updates. Having strong, unique passwords for every service that you use is important. Multi-factor authentication plays a big part, benefit, and is certainly on any high-risk services that you, or high-impact services that you have out there. Multi-factor authentication is highly, highly recommended. Be suspicious as always. And router security is something that is important on desktops and so forth. Doesn't really apply to smartphones. Again, going back to the firewall, the biggest security you get out of a router is the fact that it has a really good inbound firewall. And as I noted above, firewalls don't really apply on smartphones. So that's it.
Question came in from John. If I log in using saved credentials, I am not typing the information, does a keystroke logger capture that information?
It shouldn't. But if an attacker has access at that level where they can be trapping keystrokes, they could potentially be trapping traffic, network traffic as well, but that would be encrypted at that point. It's probably much less of a risk if you have a saved password, but saved passwords then present other issues on your computer. If anybody manages to get physical access to your computer and you have saved passwords, that could be an issue. If you have a computer, especially if you have a computer that auto logs on, that you don't need a password to access your computer, or you have a weak password to access your computer, if they can get access to your computer, fire up your browser, then potentially they could log on as you to anywhere where you have a saved password.
Now, Stuart says that the most secure mobile banking is when you walk down to the branch and make an in-person transaction.
I'm glad
and
there's Jim a smiley
says,
on that.
As long as it's a live teller.
Yeah, I have heard stories of people that have replaced the entire front panels for ATM machines with their own devices, and you come up, put in your PIN number, and then they'll throw up an error message or something like that saying that, oh, something went wrong, you have to see your branch to get your card back. Meanwhile, they've captured your card and your PIN number and can go use it elsewhere.
Yeah, that happened to me a long time ago.
Yeah, a number of years ago, the Royal Bank at Centerpoint, the drive-through, that same exact thing happened.
Yeah.
They put a false front on the two drive-through instant tellers, and I went there to cash my paycheck one time, and the whole place was ringed with police, yellow evidence tape there, and a whole bunch of cops and detectives and other people were wandering around trying to figure out what was going on. So
I have in the past on public ATMs where I've heard of not ones where they replace the entire front, but they just replace the card slot. They have a thing that covers that and has something it inserts into the actual card slot. And so I've taken to whenever I use an ATM machine, I'll give that thing a really good shake and push on it and see if it feels loose at all. If it feels solid, I figure, okay, if I ever get one where that thing moves at all, I'm not going to use that ATM.
Did you have a comment, Tim?
Oh, yes. I said years ago it happened to me at a Bank of Montreal in downtown Ottawa.
Yeah.
Oh, well. And Jocelyn says using an old phone to do banking isn't very secure. It's pretty easy to connect to the wires and record all the keystrokes you make. in my building, I can easily access the wire bundle with all the wire pairs. Of course, I think you have to know what you're doing to do that, too.
But again, if you're connecting at that level, you're connecting into, you can sniff the traffic, but if it's an encrypted session, it won't help. I don't think you could successfully pull off a man in the middle. Well, actually, I suppose theoretically, yes, you could do a man in the middle where you disconnect them from the public switch network and they connect on your behalf. I guess it'd be possible, but that's a long shot, I think.
No, in the case of old phone system, is you are using the keypads of your phone. So you enter your account number, you enter your PIN and all the things. So all you need is to read the keys that you're pressing on your old phone. And that's just for a few dollars. You can get a chip that connect to your pair and read all the keystroke you're pressing.
Oh, I guess, yeah, I guess if you were using phone banking, yeah, okay, I get it, yeah, I see that, yeah, but I wonder if anybody is still using telephone banking. I suppose you could.
Yeah, for those that use that, that's probably the least secure way of doing it.
Yeah.
If you're doing banking from home, is it more secure to use a laptop with an Ethernet cable than a smartphone over Wi-Fi, even though you're on your own router?
Again, in theory, somebody could do a man-in-the-middle attack, but it'd be really difficult to pull off because they would have to bring up an access point that would have a stronger signal than your wireless router in order to trick your computer into connecting to it rather than yours. And then they could do a man-in-the-middle attack. But, I mean, that's a real long shot, I think. So I think as long as you are on your own router, the chances of it being less secure than an Ethernet connection is probably pretty, pretty low. Like, I to the point where I wouldn't even consider it to be less secure. You know, I wouldn't worry about it myself.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So moving along, we'll move to a computer basics item. Some people wonder why there are so many icons on people's desktops, and the question is, how do they all get there? And if you want to create an icon to a specific program, how do you do that? And another question that came up was, what happens if I remove shortcuts? And then finally, can I create custom shortcuts to other things that are of interest? The automatic installation, as soon as you install Windows, and if you do a fresh install, you'll get at least two shortcuts on your desktop. One will be for the recycle bin, and the other one, because Microsoft loves to have you use their browser, will be for Microsoft Edge. And then when you install additional programs, they generally want to add a desktop shortcut as part of the installation. And if they're nice about it, they'll actually ask you. And for example, here's Notepad++, and they have a checkbox where you can create a shortcut or not by checking the box or not. Some people aren't quite so polite, and you'll get the shortcuts anyway. If you want to add shortcuts, then basically you're looking for a program file. So in Windows, you're going to find those generally in the program files folder or the program files 86 folder. So you need to find out where the program is that you want to make the shortcut for, and look, what you're looking for is some kind of name with it, usually a .exe extension, so that's an executable file. And then all you need to do is right-click on that file name, and you'll get a couple of options in the context menu. One is Send to Desktop, which creates a shortcut on the desktop. The other one can be Create a Shortcut, and again, you'll generally select for the desktop. And Chris noted another method, which is quite interesting. If you press the Windows key and the R key, Windows R, that will bring up the run box. And then what you do is you type shell:apps folder. And that brings up a window with all of your installed programs. And then you can drag any icon for any of these programs to the desktop. And you might ask, why would you go to that much trouble? And the question is, supposing you wanted to do it for Microsoft Word, and it isn't Word.exe that you're looking for. And even worse, do you know where to find the executable file for Microsoft Word? And I'll leave that as an exercise for your homework. It's kind of an interesting process. Anyway, basically, here's the two folders that we're generally looking for on the C drive, program files and x86. And if we open one of those, and let's say we pick up this program here called duplicatecleaner.exe, and right-click on that, then here we get the send to menu, and we can tell it to send the icon to the desktop. Or alternatively, we can create a shortcut. And once we do that, it says, well, I can't create the shortcut here in this program files directory. Do you want to put it on the desktop instead? And the answer is yes, I do. And then whichever one of those options you choose, you'll end up with an icon on your desktop, which links directly to the program of interest. Now, supposing we want to actually do the opposite, we want to remove a shortcut. The shortcuts are usually stored in the users folder. So typically it'll be in C:users, your username, and then the desktop folder. And you notice that is not program files of x86. It's not where the program's stored. This is only where the shortcuts are stored. So if you delete a shortcut and you remove the shortcut from this desktop folder, but you don't do anything to the software itself, i.e. the executable program is still in place. You haven't deleted the .exe file. You've only deleted the shortcut to it. And Chris again notes that where it's normally in this desktop users folder, if you install the program for all users rather than just an individual user, the shortcut may end up in this C:users public desktop folder. So you might have to go and look in there for certain shortcuts. And also be careful. Personally, I don't do this, but if you have a portable application and even regular programs, you can install them to the desktop directly. And so if you want to make sure that you're deleting a shortcut and not the actual program file, make sure that you see this little shortcut arrow on the icon, which tells you that this is actually a shortcut. So for example, you can see here I've got an icon, which is actually linking to a .py file. So this is a Python script, program code. And so you can have shortcuts not only to programs, but you can have them to doc files and PDF files and images and all kinds of things. And here's the shortcuts. Here's that desktop folder. And you'll notice that my shortcut is between a shortcut for Opera, the browser, and pzip, which is a zip program. And if I were to go to the desktop and right-click on the icon here, it would bring up this context menu, and I could choose to delete the shortcut from the screen. And once I do that, you'll notice that it moves the shortcut to the recycle bin. So it moved it from the display screen into the recycle bin, and it's gone from down here. Remember, it was between Opera and pzip, and now there is nothing between Opera and pzip. So I have indeed deleted that shortcut. If I want to create a custom shortcut, I can right-click anywhere on the desktop, and in the context menu, I select New and a New Shortcut. And then I can use a wizard, which will allow me to browse the location of the program and give a shocker the name. And notice that it doesn't just have to be a program. You can enter a command string here to create a custom shortcut with a Windows command. And we'll see how that works in just a second. So here's that context menu where we've right-clicked on the desktop. We've got new, we've got shortcut. We click on shortcut, and we get this wizard where we can browse to an x86 folder, find this program, tell it I want to call it this particular name, and then I can tell it to finish, and here's my custom icon to any program that I want to have. Now, one of the things you can do using commands and these custom icons is do a rapid shutdown or a rapid restart. Because in Windows, if you do it the kind of classic way, you have to click the mouse three times. You have to go to the start menu. You have to select the power icon. And then you have to choose either shutdown or restart. So you need to do three clicks to shut down or restart your computer. Question is, can you do it in two clicks? And in fact, can you even do it with a single click? And the answer is yes, you can. Because if you remember a long time ago, 2015, I wrote this article about the shutdown.exe program. This is basically how Windows shuts down your computer. So you can write a command like this to call up the program and give it some switches to either shut the computer down or restart it. And that command looks exactly the same. So something's wrong there, I think. Should be an R in one of those. Yeah, here's the restart command. So I'm creating a new shortcut, and now I'm giving it a command. So I'm telling it to go to System32, run the shutdown program, and slash R is for restart. Slash S will be for shutdown. And then I can tell it that I want that to be called restart. I give it a nice icon. And now I have a couple of icons on my desk where I can now just double click on one of these icons and my computer will restart so I can boot Linux, or it will shut down and I can go watch television instead. And if you want to have a single click, what you do is you grab the icons and you drag them down to the taskbar. Because now once the icon's on the taskbar, one click on this icon will actually shut the computer down. So there's a couple of interesting ways to use this idea of custom shortcuts and icons on the desktop to do things very efficiently. Okay, and I see Chris has put those commands in the window and has very kindly changed it to the right command. So thanks, Chris.
You caught me in time.
And moving along, Chris has got something on a new vulnerability.
Yeah, I've pasted into the chat a bunch of the information off of these slides. There's the internet security sites have lit up the last about 3 days about a new zero-day vulnerability. Zero-day vulnerability is a vulnerability that comes out for which a patch is not available from the vendor in order to fix the particular problem. And so it's been given a CVE, or Common Vulnerability and Exploit Number. Microsoft actually finally got around to deciding that this really deserves to be called a vulnerability. For the first month after it was reported to them, they didn't think it was a problem. It actually is a big problem. It's in the Microsoft Support Diagnostic Tool Protocol Handler, and it's a vulnerability. It's not a bug. It's actually designed. It's working as designed. It's just that Microsoft didn't think that it was going to be abused in this sort of way. So the end result is that it allows for remote code execution, which is the worst kind of vulnerability. It means that basically an attacker can run anything they want on your computer. And there is proof of concept of this out there in a number of places, and there's live exploit code where the attackers are actually using this to do terrible things to people's computers. And in the example that is out there right now, it allows for execution of this arbitrary code, essentially, just by viewing a malicious Word document. And it executes a PowerShell script via this protocol, the MSDT protocol. And anybody who knows PowerShell knows that you can do pretty much anything you want on your computer in PowerShell. And so the ability to actually do this via the MSDT protocol is pretty bad news. And this works even if macros are not enabled. Microsoft long ago came out with a thing where by default, macros will not be run, and you will see a pop-up saying, do you want to allow macros or not? This doesn't, with any sort of pop-up, it will just execute as soon as you open up or view that document, even if you preview it in Windows. We can expect more abuses of protocol handlers that are going to be coming down the line, and there are well over a dozen different Microsoft protocol handlers for their different tools that are on the computer. So if you want to read up more on it, there's the Microsoft the Security Resource Center. They have a page explaining about it and what you can do to mitigate the problem. And if you want to get into more on the geeky side of things, SANS, which is Security Audit Network, I forget what this stands for, but it's a company that basically they do train security professionals. And they had a webcast that I took part in yesterday, early afternoon, I guess it was, and they've now posted it to YouTube. So if you want, you can go to there and you can get some of the geeky details about what this is and why it's actually a big deal. Next. So dealing with the vulnerability, Microsoft and most other security professionals are now recommending that you actually remove the MSDT protocol handler in the registry. It's not a difficult thing to do. It's easy to put it back if you actually decide later on that you actually want it. But until Microsoft actually fixes this protocol handler, it's highly recommended that you actually do this. It's two-step processes you should go through. First is the backup. The registry key for the MSDT protocol handler. That way you can restore it easily if you need to do so. It's very likely that you don't need that, especially a home environment. There are cases in enterprise environments where MSDT is actually used. It's actually the Microsoft troubleshooter is what this is all about. And certainly in enterprise environments, it is sometimes used. Home environments, not so much. And it doesn't prevent you from actually running it. It's just you can remotely trigger the tool. So you'd, even after removing this registry key, you'd still be able to run the troubleshooters locally. And then you actually delete the registry key for it. No reboot is required. As soon as you delete the registry key, it's in effect. So next. So the way you do this is you run a command prompt as administrator. So if you just click the start button and type in CMD, you will see a command prompt come up with the results at the top. If you're on a recent build of or feature release of Windows, you will also see a right-hand panel where you'll actually have an option run as administrator. If you are in an older build, you won't see that. And so you have to right-click where it says command prompt in the results and choose from the pop-up run as administrator. Then you type in two commands. So the first one is the export. So this is taking that hkey-classes root, which is where this particular registry key is stored. And the registry key is called ms-msdt. And then you follow that with the file name that you want to write the contents of that registry key to. If you use the one that I've put in there, it will write it to your documents folder into a file called restore_msdt.reg. If you know what you're doing, you can write it to any file, anywhere you choose to write it to. Just everything in yellow is the location and the file name you want to store that into. If you are going to have spaces in it, where user profile can sometimes have spaces in it, make sure you quote things so that it treats it as one string. Then after that, you run the reg delete, and that'll actually delete the registry key MS-MSDT. And if you ever have to restore it, you will have that, in this case, restore msdt.reg file. If you double-click it, Windows will ask you, are you sure you want to enter this into the registry? It'll give you a warning that if you enter gobbledygook, you can damage Windows. Because this was originally from the registry, it's safe. You just say yes, go ahead and do that, and it'll enter it back into the registry. You probably will never actually need to re-enter it into the registry. So that's all I have on that. I do highly recommend that people actually do go through those steps and remove those that registry key from Windows. It will 100% mitigate the current vulnerability that has been designed into the protocol handler.
So, given that that's a nasty issue, how long before Microsoft patch it?
It's anybody's guess, because it's not that it's a bug. It's functionality that they designed into the protocol handler. The two that are being exploited right now are basically read from a file and execute a file. And those are functions that Microsoft deemed, you know, it's all documented within the protocol handler, and there could be customers that depend upon that functionality. So I'm not sure how they're going to fix it, other than the only way that I see is just they remove that functionality from it, and any customer that is currently using it, it's going to break something on them. So who knows? Microsoft has not been very forthcoming on how they intend to fix it or when they'll fix it. They just have mitigation instructions, which is basically that delete that registry key.
And what you're saying for the Joe user, we don't use that.
No.
Handler, so we can delete the key and it won't really affect anything we do.
Yeah. And as I said, though, this is not actually new either. The idea that the Microsoft protocol handlers have been abused in other ways in the past. And so you can bet your dollars to donuts that the attackers are out there looking at the other protocol handlers to see, is there some other ones that they can abuse as well? So I expect, and Sans actually said too, they don't expect this to be the final word on this issue of the protocol handlers. They said they hope they don't have to have an emergency webcast, which was what they deemed yesterday's to be, but they fully expect to be revisiting this in the future.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Chris. That's very, very useful information.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. It's time for another one of Bob Walker's series in his video and audio tools issues. So, Bob, take it away.
Okay, let me just share the screen here. Share. And there we go. Let me bring up the presentation here. And here we go. Okay, so this week in the series, so far we've covered how to download complete videos or just the audio tracks of videos from YouTube and YouTube type sites using a video download helper. We've also covered how to capture videos that you can't download the other way, using Daveu video capture and screen recorder software. And we've also covered how to do still and video screen capture using Screen Hunter Pro, all-in-one screen capture and screen recording software. So tonight we're going to cover how to capture or rip, as the they call it, audio from a video file, and how to take a screenshot of the current video frame using GOM Player. Now, the reason I chose GOM Player is if you look at most of the websites that rate video players, their top picks usually always include VLC Media Player and GOM Player, and both of these are excellent video players. VLC is has a few more features, but as many of the reviews say, there's a steep learning curve. It's not that easy to use. GOM is easier to use, and it still has lots and lots of features. And there are URLs at the end of this presentation on some of these review sites, so you can read the detailed reviews yourself and get some feel, and also look at some of the other alternative video players. Now, VLC is one of the best, probably the best free video players on the market. It's open source, cross-platform. It can play all sorts of different formats. It's absolutely free. There's no paid-for version. Has lots of other great features. But it has that issue with the steep learning curve. GOM is rated as one of the best free media players available in the market. And it has lots of great features. As far as the cons go, the help feature isn't all that great. And they have this nasty habit when you install the software, and every time you do an upgrade to the latest version, which is fairly frequent, they try and sneak some extra software into it. So you got to be very careful going through the steps and decline to have any of the other stuff available. Now, they used to only have a free version, and they recently came out with a paid version. And so if you download and install the free version, you may have to suffer the occasional ad. Now, the paid-for version is called GOM Player Plus. It supports a few more features than the free version. It's ad-free, and it costs between $15 and $25 U.S. dollars. And this sort of depends on the tides and the phases of the moon. Any day you go to the site to get it, the price changes back and forth between those two extremes. If you go to the site, GOM Labs has a whole raft of different audio and video related software products that are complementary to the GOM Player and to do a lot of other things. We're going to have a look at the interface here. And what I'm going to do here is go right to the actual interface here. And because I have this annoying Zoom bar at the top of my screen, I can't do this full screen. But if you click on Settings here for Preferences, or if you hit F5, you get the Preferences menu to do some of the general setup. And typically when you're doing a setup for this for the first time, you're going to want to click on General. And what you want to do is make sure that the auto hide the mouse cursor while playing is on. And where is it here? And we'll cover a couple other things in a second here. And you can close the settings menu. If you click pretty much anywhere on GOM Player or do a right click, you get the operating menu. And you come to any particular thing and you get sub menus and whatever. Very, very feature rich. And you can also get to the preferences menu down here. There's another menu called Control Panel, which you can click on down here, and brings up a whole bunch of toys you can play with to do all sorts of different functions. In this corner, we have the usual close, maximize, restore, and minimize icons. As well, you can go full screen here, or you can just hit the enter key and it will go full screen. So the other thing I missed here is if you're in the preferences, if you go to the general preferences, show preview screen when exploring using file playback bar on, that's another thing you really want to do what we're going to show you tonight. Now we're going to look at how to take a screen snapshot from a video. So what you can do is you start playing the video you want to get the screenshot off of, and then you pause it. And then you bring up this preview screen here by moving the mouse along what you call the file playback bar here. And you can move it along, and you see the preview screen changing as you go through the file. And when you get to pretty much where you want to go, you click on it and bring up the video at that point. So if the point you get to is just not quite exactly where you want to be, you can move forward or back one frame at a time by going F or control forward or back or control backward. Or you can move 10 seconds at a time using the shortcut keys shown here. When you get to the frame you want to take the shot of, you can hit control E to take the shot. Taking the shot moves the video forward a frame, so you can take several shots in a row to review and edit later. The two test shots you see above are only actually three shots apart on the video that I took it from. And then the shots will later be in the See Users, Your Username, Documents, GOM Player, Capture folder. And I'll go through this live in just a minute. Now you got to keep in mind that some parts of the frames of the video where there's lots of action may be blurred. And in the case of this particular video, this is Ringo Starr playing a guest shot on this video. And look at his drumsticks, you can hardly see them. So this is one of the reasons you may want to start a few frames ahead of where you want to actually take the shot and take several shots in a row, so you can choose the best one. Now, to rip the audio, you open GOM Player and you hit the Shift G key, set of keys, and bring up the Advanced Audio Capture window. And the video can actually be playing when you do this. And you may want to just grab the window and move it over to the side because it comes up right in the middle of the screen where you want to see what's going on. You go to the format box, number one here, and you click on the menu, and you select MP3. Otherwise, the default is an option you might want to have. And then the other thing you do is you check off the auto capture on startup box down here. Now you close GOM Player, then double click the video in the file manager to start it up. And to do this, you need to set GOM Player as your default video player. As soon as the video starts, because of the settings you've made, the audio track is being captured as the video is playing. And as soon as the video is finished playing, right as soon as it's finished playing, click up in the corner and close GOM Player. The audio track will be in the same folder as your audio track there. Same folder as your snapshot. And you can set a different capture folder for the audios by opening up the operating menu and going to audio and then open up a capture folder. So while you've got this feature going, you can double-click another video in File Manager, trip another audio track, and keep on doing it the same way you did the first one. And when you're finished ripping the entire suite of audio tracks you want, open GOM Player, hit the Shift-G key to bring up the Advanced Audio Capture window, and uncheck the audio capture on startup box, and then click the close box in the lower right-hand corner of the window. If you don't do this, every time you open up a video in GOM Player, you're going to start recording the audio track. Now, if you want to only record a section of the audio track, because a lot of videos, especially music videos, have a lot of stuff, video type stuff at the beginning and the end. But if all you want is just the music track, so you can play it in your car or whatever else, you only want to record a part of the audio track. So what you want to do is double click the video in File Manager to start it up and then pause it immediately. Hit the Shift-G key to bring up the Advanced Audio Capture window. And again, you might want to move the window to the side. And you go to the Format box, make sure you're on MP3 there. And then you unpause the video. And you got to be quick about this next step. As it gets to the place you want to start ripping the audio, click on the Start box, which is number one here. And as the video gets to where you want to stop ripping, click on the stop box there. So you got the start, you got the stop right here. And if you don't close GOM, well, anyway, you can go back and close this video window later. So let's have a quick look at this and show. I'm going to bring up a video here. And first off, I'm going to pause it. And then you go up to the bar here. And you can see as I move along the bar, you go to various spots in the video. And when you get to something you want, You click on it, and it takes you to that spot in the video. So it's very easy to move around. Whatever. And you start playing it again. And if I right click and go up to audio, and advanced audio capture, that brings up this window here. I'm going to move it to the side here. And you can see here the format. I have MP3 set. You can also get Windows Wave format, which is certain, or Ogg Vorbis, which is not a very common format. So MP3 is probably the one you're going to want to stay with. Here's the auto capture on startup box. And then here's the start and stop to start and stop recording the audio. And then the close box. So now there's a bunch of URLs here, some on Gone Video Player, some on Video Land, the reviews and all that. There's all sorts of great video players out there. If you're looking for something free or fairly inexpensive, either GOM or VideoLand are excellent choices. They're not the only ones that can do some of this screenshots and audio captures, but they're two of the more popular ones. And So next time around, we're going to look at how to take your CDs and rip them into MP3s using ExpressRip CD player or CD ripper. And after that, we'll look at how to edit the tags or the metadata on your MP3s. So when you play them in your MP3 player, or on your car infotainment system, it comes up with all the right information. And that's it for tonight.
Okay, thanks Bob. And moving along, I'll wrap up. We're a few minutes over, so we'll go any questions. I just remind you that next Monday is the third in our series of Tech Talks. Lawrence is going to be talking about scams. So if you want to attend that, you need to register and we'll send you the credentials. And then next Wednesday, there's no Q&A because we're having our first, for a long time, in-person pizza queue. So this is going to be at Vincent Massey Park. And I remind you that scheduled start time is 6 o'clock and the pizza is supposed to be arriving at 6:30. So certainly you want to be there by 6:30. And the details are on the website and also in the newsletter. And because we have a pizza queue, there won't be a Q&A next week. We'll be in the park munching on pizza, I guess. So our next Q&A will be in 2 weeks on June the 15th. So if you have questions or things that you want to share, send us a note to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And thanks for attending tonight. Nice seeing everyone.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you at the park. Except Stu.
And Bill.
And Bill.
And a whole bunch of people who don't live.
Yeah, actually, there's a few out of towners for sure. So.
We're gonna have to mail pizza in future.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, John Fleming won't be here either. He's at BC.
Anyone between.
Enjoy the.